This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Eric spearheads Sightline's work on energy policy. He has published more than 200 articles, reports, and analyses on a range of issues connected to fossil fuel transport, including carbon emissions, local pollution, transportation system impacts, rail policy, and economics. Eric DePlace is here to give us an update on fossil fuel development projects in the Pacific Northwest and to tell us about his new report, Northwest Targets, Communities Threatened by Coal, Oil, and Gas. Welcome, Eric.
Well, thanks for having me, Diane.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about Sightline Institute?
Sure. Sightline Institute is a think tank. We are based in Seattle, and we work across the Northwest trying to make the Northwest a global model of sustainability. So we work on a whole range of issues, many of which are connected to classic environmental problems like climate and energy, and others are broader issues that touch on aspects of our economy like housing affordability or democracy reform.
Would you remind us of what you call the thin green line?
The thin green line is a concept that we developed at Sightline that sort of characterizes how we fit into the new global energy economy. Historically, the Northwest was sort of a backwater when it came to coal, oil, and gas. Nobody really paid much attention to us. But the economy has changed dramatically in North America and globally. And what's happened is that we are now right in the center of a big debate. We are sort of pinned between these huge deposits of carbon fuel reserves in the middle of the continent, Alberta tar sands, Powder River Basin coal, Bakken shale oil, some others. And on the other side of us are the fastest growing energy markets in the world. And those are principally in East Asia. And as a consequence of this geographic location, we are at the crossroads of a tremendous pressure to move coal, oil, and gas to those markets through our backyard. And so the decisions we're making here have not just regional significance, but truly global significance about how those industries play out, how climate change plays out. So the debates we're having now are of global import.
What is the goal of your new report, Northwest Targets, and what did you examine?
The goal of the report is to look backward over the last 7 or 8 years at the coal export fight, at the oil train discussions we've had, and then also look forward to what's coming down the pike. And the idea is that the Northwest has been inundated, Oregon and Washington have been inundated with proposals to ship coal, oil, gas, petrochemicals. So we've seen dozens and dozens of these proposals come up. And so what we tried to do is examine where those happened, why they failed, because almost all of them ended up failing, and figure out where the new threats are likely to be and what the nature of those new threats are. And the idea is to give us a clear sense for what the dynamics of the global energy economy are like and how it's going to affect us in this region.
Which communities did you evaluate?
So we looked at every single community in Oregon and Washington that has seen any proposal for coal exports, for oil by rail, for natural gas exports, natural gas liquefaction, petrochemical development. So we looked at about a dozen communities across Oregon and Washington that have seen these projects and then looked at every single project that's been proposed in those communities since about 2010.
How did you determine the risk for dirty energy expansion in the Northwest communities you evaluated?
So the idea was, like I said, to go back and review the history of the last 7 or 8 years and remind ourselves how it is that all of these proposals came onto the table in the first place and then why subsequently almost all of them failed. There are still several large outstanding questions, but many of these projects have been resolved. And then there's kind of I think of it as three waves of a tsunami. The first wave was coal exports. Second wave was oil trains. And then the third wave, the wave that is still cresting right now, is this kind of world of fracked gas, petrochemicals. The industry refers to it as light hydrocarbons. And so that's methanol refining, liquefied natural gas, and some companion projects. So we took a look and reviewed all of those old projects, and then we tried to figure out how many are still on the table and which places are susceptible to new project proposals because of the way that they think about land use or don't think about land use, as it turns out. The way we zone our cities and our ports turns out to be a major driver of future threats.
Before we go into more detail, would you give an overview of the key findings from your report?
Sure. The big takeaway from this report is that there are many, many communities in the Northwest that have been threatened by or impacted by proposals to ship coal, oil, and gas to foreign markets or to elaborate the North American energy economy. But the biggest places that are at risk, the places that are most under threat from new development are, in order, the Lower Columbia River. So there's kind of a cluster of public ports, Longview, Kalama on the Washington side, and a place called Port Westward, which is near Clatskanie on the Oregon side. Those three ports are right in the crosshairs of new energy development, and they have interrelated projects. So their futures are sort of bound together, those three ports on the lower Columbia. That's number one. Number two is Tacoma in the South Sound. Tremendous pressure to build large-scale energy infrastructure there. And I'll go on about Tacoma a bit more in this interview because I think it's one of the most important places to watch right now. And then number three is in Whatcom County, an area called Cherry Point, which is historically Lummi Nation land. It is also the site of a couple of oil refineries and some other projects. A huge amount of pressure has been put on Cherry Point, although there are some positive signs in development there that I think will hopefully reduce the threats to that particular region. So those are the three in order: Lower Columbia River, Tacoma, and then Cherry Point.
Let's talk in more detail now about the communities that you just referred to. So your number one most at-risk area is the Lower Columbia River. So which dirty energy projects are still at play there?
Well, the biggest one that we're all watching and hoping will eventually crumble is the Millennium Bulk Coal Export Project. It would be the biggest coal export terminal anywhere in North America by a long shot. It is sort of in zombie status. It seems like it's probably dead, but it's still ambling forward. The finances don't look good for it. It doesn't have a key lease, but the project backers are continuing to act as if they can still build that project and move the coal through there. Tremendously environmentally damaging project that we hope will be stopped in the reasonably near future. That's a big one there. The other big one that's been of moment in the last few months is methanol refining. So the way methanol would be produced in the projects that are proposed there in Kalama and also on the Port Westward site, which is in Oregon, would be to pipe in huge, staggering quantities of natural gas, like more natural gas than is used in every power plant in the state combined, and then mix that with large quantities of water and electricity and essentially refine it into liquid methanol, which is a petrochemical, ship that to China and use it in plastics manufacturing. So there are some other projects that are worth discussing too, but the real big ones to pay attention to, coal exports and methanol development on the Lower Columbia, are the big ones.
What makes the Lower Columbia River a favorable target?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, the main reason is, I guess there are sort of two main reasons. One is that they're relatively economically distressed communities. They have not prospered in the way that Seattle and Portland have. So they are seen as vulnerable by the industry. They're seen as willing to accept projects that are probably not going to make the economy any better and might make it worse. But they don't have a lot of other good options, quite frankly. And two is the fact that their land use regulations are extremely permissive when it comes to these projects. And so if you want to go develop a huge petrochemical site or you want to develop, you know, a coal export site or an oil by rail site, you're going to go to a place where the land use doesn't prohibit you from doing that. And those sites, that cluster of ports on the Lower Columbia, is prime territory when it comes to land use regulation or lack of regulation, I should say.
In what ways are the projects a problem for the communities in which they are being proposed?
This is a good question because you can zero in all the way down to really, really localized impacts that have a tremendous impact on local neighborhoods and then zoom all the way out to global climate issues. So if you live in Longview and you're thinking about what's going to happen to your community if there are 44 million tons of coal exported through that city every year, you're looking at traffic congestion from all the coal trains moving in and out, which are heavy and slow moving and very long. You're looking at coal dust blowing off the trains and blowing off the stockpiles, all sorts of things of that nature. Then new construction on the river of wharfs and piers that will impact fishing, that will impact the shorelines, the natural habitat there. And if you think about petrochemical development in the sense of methanol refining, there are certainly some air quality impacts from that. Again, you know, changes to the development on the river and how that impacts kind of the quality of life that's historically been present in that region. You know, so end of the day, you look at those localized impacts and it's pretty much all downside. You do get a small number of jobs at some of these sites, that's real, but the overall trade-off is probably not beneficial for the economy, certainly not beneficial for local environmental health. Then you scale way up and you look at, well, what are the impacts of shipping that much coal, of making plastic that much cheaper for China? And it doesn't really look like there's any environmental benefit at all to these projects. It looks like it's almost literally all downside.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Our topic is the report, Northwest Targets, Communities Threatened by Coal, Oil, and Gas. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. What projects are still at play in Tacoma, number two on your list of threatened communities?
Yeah, so Tacoma is a really interesting case study right now. I want to sort of back up by about a year. Tacoma became embroiled in one of the most vicious fights I've seen in the last 8 years over fossil fuel development. And that was over a methanol refining project that would have been twice as big as the monster proposed at Calama. It would have been far and away the biggest petrochemical site of that nature of methanol in the entire world. And it was proposed for what's called the Tide Flats, which is the industrial port area that everybody sees when you drive by I-5, but it's quite close to some residential neighborhoods. It's also very directly impacts the Puyallup tribe, which is their sort of historic land there. That fight was enormously consequential, and it really divided the city politically and culturally in some ways. The project backers subsequently withdrew that proposal after the fight became intensely rancorous. And so what's left on the table in Tacoma now is a project backed by Puget Sound Energy, which is a Western Washington gas utility, to build a natural gas liquefaction site and then store gas there. And then we're seeing the proliferation of small projects at the U.S. oil refinery there at Targa Sound Terminals to begin to move more oil by rail than they're already moving, and then to begin to ship some new kinds of products, things like natural gasoline and condensate, which are byproducts of fracking, often used in the extraction of tar sands. And so what they're trying to do in some of those places is participate in various ways in kind of the larger energy extraction issues happening elsewhere in the region. And I think when you look at Tacoma, you look at the rail access, you look at the pipeline access, you look at the deep water port, it is a prime real estate for future energy projects like the methanol refinery proposal that we wrestled with last year. And who knows what could come in the future, but I would think propane by export is likely to come that way. Certainly there are a range of things that could happen.
What are the key risks of these projects to the Tacoma community?
Yeah, well, you get a whole range of risks when you site this stuff in an urban area. It is typically the case that you don't put liquefied natural gas in a residential area because, I'll say right up front, generally speaking, the stuff is handled with a good deal of safety and consideration. But when accidents happen, they're catastrophic. Liquefied natural gas facilities can blow up like a huge bomb. That actually happened in Plymouth, Washington, which is sort of near the Tri-Cities. There was a liquefied natural gas facility out there, and that thing blew up. It almost killed a bunch of people. But you cite those things typically far away. So if you're a local in Tacoma, there's a very legitimate fear about the risk of explosions and immediate health and safety hazards. I'll also note that it's in an area that's hard to serve with emergency services. It's near the immigration detention facility. The people there cannot flee in the event of an accident. So there are those risks. And then on top of that, then there are all the sort of longer-term risks of being near polluting industries. So you have the risk of, let's say, benzene in the air. You have other air pollution risks. Tacoma residents are, as a general matter, very, very aware of how local pollution can impact their health and their safety and their long-term viability as a city. People there get it. Many of them grew up in the shadow of the Asarco smelter. It is something they feel keenly, and I think there's a lot of justice in the complaints that they make that they have been targeted again and again by dirty industries that don't have their best interests at heart.
Which fossil fuel projects are still at play at Cherry Point, the number three on your list of threatened communities?
Yeah, at Cherry Point, we're looking at kind of a different suite of projects. So we've got two big refineries up there, both of which receive oil trains and both of which are likely to begin using those oil trains to oversupply their needs and actually export crude oil off the docks. There's some tricky dynamics up there. They're also possibly looking at a pipeline expansion that would come down from Canada, probably a sister project to a big oil pipeline expansion that's on the books, proposed in Canada right now, not yet built. And then Whatcom County, Cherry Point has become the first and only major West Coast exporter of propane, most of it delivered by rail. So many people are familiar with oil trains, which have a propensity to derail and blow up pretty catastrophically. We've seen about a dozen of those explosions over the last few years in North America. Propane by rail is similar. It also can derail and explode catastrophically. It's probably quite lucrative for the industry right now. So as a consequence of extensive fracking operations in British Columbia, Canada is producing a lot of both natural gas and some byproducts like propane, and they want to move that stuff to foreign markets. The propane from Whatcom County is going to Japan. I think there's going to be more pressure for moving propane by rail and then to vessel and shipping that to Asia. I think that's probably the industry to watch at Cherry Point and other places as well.
To what extent would additional fossil fuel infrastructure be needed to allow proposed projects to go forward in the three most vulnerable communities?
I think that's a great question. And in the top three target zones, you know, most of the infrastructure is already in place. Typically, what the project backers are looking for is relatively small scale. They're looking at building a new rail loop or some new loading facility like a pier terminal, sometimes storage tanks for liquid fuel. Methanol is the exception to that. They actually need to build a big, huge petrochemical refinery. But most of the stuff is already in place, and that's what makes them so vulnerable to new project proposals. Other places like Hoquiam have been targeted in the past, but the infrastructure there isn't quite as good. They're not as well served by rail access or by pipeline access, for example. So the threats tend to be a little bit diminished in some places like that.
In addition to the three communities that we've just spoken about, would you highlight other dirty fossil fuel projects still at play in the Pacific Northwest that might be of note?
It's always worth noting that there's stuff happening in Canada, too, that affects us. I didn't talk about this in the report as much, but it is very much on my mind, and I think on a lot of people's mind, this proposal to elaborate or basically triple the size of the Trans Mountain pipeline in British Columbia. It runs from Alberta to British Columbia. That's a big, big project that could have a huge impact on the Salish Sea. We're looking at that one very closely right now. But if you sort of look at the contents of the report, which focused just on Oregon and Washington, you would look at Hoquiam. There were a suite of coal export and oil by rail proposals there. Those have all died. In Vancouver, Washington, which I think is another really interesting place to watch, we have one big, big project still left, and that is sometimes called the Tesoro Savage Project. It would be the biggest oil by rail unloading facility anywhere in North America. So you'd be looking at 5-6 oil trains per day coming into Vancouver, loading that stuff onto vessels and then moving it out to either domestic or foreign refineries. That project we have been watching very closely for years. We think it will be settled probably by the end of the summer or by the fall. Certainly one of the most consequential fossil fuel export projects still on the books anywhere right now, anywhere in North America right now. In terms of other things still to watch, you know, I think the track record suggests that as much money as the industry brings, as much political pressure as they can bear to bring, they're actually a lot weaker than they seem like. And so it used to be that when we looked at these huge number of projects, we thought, well, gosh, there's almost no way the industry is not going to get all or most of them, or at least some of them built. And the actual track record is just the opposite. It suggests that community by community, residents have fought back, First Nations and tribes have fought back, environmental advocates have stood up and have defeated almost every one of these projects, community by community. And I think that says something really positive about Northwest communities.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Our topic is the report, Northwest Targets, Communities Threatened by Coal, Oil, and Gas. We've alluded to this a bit already, but to what extent are fossil fuel projects in Canada driving the possibility of new projects in Washington and Oregon? How important is the Canadian input, as it were?
It's tremendously important. The border functions sort of as an imaginary line when it comes to the energy economy. So there is a huge number of the projects that we are looking at in Oregon and Washington that have some direct or indirect connection to the Canadian energy economy. I have many, many positive things to say about Canada, but one sort of troubling thing about Canada, they have been aggressive extractors of fossil fuels. They frack huge quantities of natural gas in British Columbia. The tar sands development in Alberta is staggering, and a tremendous amount of pressure to move that one way or another, and its byproducts like propane out of northwest ports south of the border. So they're really interrelated in lots of complicated ways. And one of the things that we need to do in Oregon and Washington is to make sure that we have developed land use regulations that are consistent with our values, our beliefs, and protect our health, not just sort of say, well, there's nothing we can do. It's a global energy commodity. That's not the case. We can take control of what happens in our neighborhoods.
Well, you've started alluding to this, but what are the best opportunities going forward to prevent the proposed fossil fuel projects?
The best opportunities are actually pretty straightforward, and it involves better land use regulation. And so it is the case that cities and counties everywhere, particularly in the Northwest, have the ability to set rules for building, permitting, construction, and can say no to these projects. The best example of this is Portland, Oregon. They looked at a proposal for propane by rail exports. That project almost got built, and the community stood up, said no, rejected the project, and then subsequently passed this incredibly comprehensive and assertive rezone of the city that said, no, we're not going to participate in the global fossil fuel export economy. We're going to essentially make that illegal in Portland. So Portland is the clear leader on that. But Hoquiam has zoned out the possibility of new oil train proposals, Vancouver, Washington. There's a big project still in the books, but they've zoned out future proposals like that. Aberdeen has done the same thing. Cherry Point, Whatcom County is now looking at, they're changing their countywide comprehensive plan to prevent new unrefined fossil fuel facilities. So that's the way forward, is for us to use the tools we already have at our disposal and make our land use laws reflect our values.
Which communities are most vulnerable in terms of land use laws, which are currently most undefended?
That's a great question. The one that's most undefended, again, is the Lower Columbia River. Those three ports that are in relatively economically distressed communities, there are no land use regulations that prevent this stuff there, or not in a comprehensive, sort of assertive way. And then the other one that's really ripe right now is Tacoma. Tacoma has begun having a conversation about whether that community should change. There's a conversation about a temporary moratorium to put a hold on new fossil fuel development while they engage in a longer-term planning process for the port area. That's not a settled question. If Tacoma does not take action, I believe it will almost certainly see new proposals. That's why I placed it at number two on the list in my report. As I said, Whatcom County is near the end of sort of enacting some land use regulations that will help, not entirely, but will help protect Cherry Point from future development. So that's the way forward. Hoquiam, most people don't think of that as kind of a Portland-style environmental center, but the residents of Hoquiam and of Grays Harbor, you know, they look at oil chain proposals and they see all downside for the community. So in some ways, I would point to Hoquiam, Aberdeen, Vancouver. Those have been leaders in protecting themselves from the ravages of an industry that doesn't much care for local health and safety.
Would you tell us about the interactive map you published about Northwest fossil fuel projects?
The map we published as a companion to the report, and it's a web-based interactive map. We mapped every project in Oregon, Washington, and in British Columbia that's been proposed since 2010. So you can scroll in on the map. You can kind of zoom into your local area. You can click on these icons and find some information about the projects, what they are, how big they are, what their status is. You can read some of Sightline's research reports on those projects. And I think it helps tell kind of a regional story about what's happened in the Northwest, how many of these projects have died, which ones are still on the table, and where the concentrations are.
Which parts of the fossil fuel industry are currently the strongest in the Pacific Northwest?
There are really two that I think are the ones to watch. One is anything related to tar sands development out of Alberta. So Kinder Morgan Pipeline in Canada, which I mentioned earlier, huge pipeline construction that would be based on an export model. Tar sands are still probably profitable in many locations. And then this strange world of fracked fuels. So that can be liquefied natural gas, although that is somewhat weakening now. But propane is likely, butane, which is very similar to propane. And then petrochemicals that are derived from those fuels. So methanol is certainly one to watch. So anything in that strange new world of light hydrocarbons, I like to keep my eye on. And then also the tar sands. Most people know, I think, at this point that coal is largely a dead letter. It's fading everywhere. Increasingly, shale oil, which is what's on the trains from Dakota, the Bakken shale oil, is also fading. And that will probably continue to happen, at least in part.
What is your prediction as to what extent proposed fossil fuel projects in the Northwest will go forward?
Well, my prediction is that all of them fail, actually. I think the track record of failure is one that the industry will continue to live up to. They will continue to see all of their projects blocked and stopped. They were successful in building a few rail loops at existing oil refineries. My sense is that the Northwest has the drive, the will, and the resources to continue to oppose and block every one of these projects. It's possible we'll see a methanol project at Kalama. That's very possible, but I hope not. But my sense is that even if that one does get built, we will continue to see project by project communities say no to this stuff and chart a cleaner future for themselves. And I think that's why Sightline has referred to the Northwest as the thin green line, because the Northwest has said, no, we're not going to be a global depot for fossil fuel exports. We're going to say no to this stuff. And by doing so, we are going to chart a new course for energy consumption and for the global climate.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the most important thing is to remember that local communities have all of the tools at their disposal right now to protect themselves from a dirty industry and to make a truly global difference when it comes to energy consumption and climate change. Because we are in this geographic location, because we are under so much threat, we also have this tremendous opportunity that very few places have. And that opportunity is to lock that stuff up in the ground, essentially, and say, we're not going to use it. We're not going to burn it. We want something cleaner and better for the future.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Eric.
Thanks, Diane. I appreciate it.
You were just listening to Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. For more information, check on the web at sightline.org/Northwest Targets. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and at kexp.org.